Hey, welcome along to another of our Clubland Q&As, in which I answer questions from Mark Stein Club members live around the planet. It is, 4 o'clock US Eastern Time. That means it's 5 o'clock for all my pals in Bermuda. Wait a minute. It's 5 o'clock in the Maritime Provinces. I think it's 6 o'clock in Bermuda. It is 9 p.m. if you're in London or Dublin or Edinburgh. 10 o'clock in Europe, 11 o'clock in the Middle East. Happy Wednesday morning to you if you are east of that. And I'm going to be taking your questions live for the next hour. Let's go to LJ O'Neill first, who says, do you think that the fiasco in Charlottesville, the police not providing police services, and according to some reports, funneling the Nazis to the Antifas, was deliberately set up by the mayor and governor and perhaps others to cause trouble for President Trump? It's clear that no matter what his reaction was, it was going to be proclaimed the worst thing ever. Since the Democrats and media apparently think the result is a smashing anti-Trump triumph, how many more of these will we see? I am inclined to think that the fiasco, as you put it, in Charlottesville, was deliberate. Let's back up a bit there first, LJ O'Neill. The object of this protest, ostensibly, was to protest against the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. And I agree with them on that. I don't like the removal of statues. I don't like the destruction of statues. I don't like the erasure of the past, because when a country erases its past, it risks erasing the possibility of a future. And if you happen to belong to my, I mean, I'm not a southerner from the United States, so Robert E. Lee doesn't mean one thing to me one way or the other. I'm talking about a general principle here. And in my cultural tradition, for example, there's something familiar about this because in the wake of decolonization in the 60s and 70s, we saw a lot of the removal of statues in Africa of Queen Victoria, for example. And generally speaking, it was a good rule of thumb that those countries that kept their statues of Queen Victoria prospered better than those that took them down. In Quebec City, for example, in the early 60s, the separatists blew up the statue of Queen Victoria, and the bits and pieces were carted off to a museum in Quebec. By contrast, just before Hong Kong was handed back to China in 1997, some Chinese fellow from communist China broke off the nose of Queen Victoria in Victoria Park in Hong Kong and splattered her with red kind of communist blood. And the commies, to their credit, did what the separatist government in Quebec didn't do. They cleaned up Queen Victoria and repaired her. So I don't believe the erasure of statues is a small thing, because when you erase the past, you make the possibility of a future, a shared future, much more difficult. And I would also say, too, that even if you don't know Robert E. Lee, don't like Robert E. Lee, empathy. We talk about empathy all the time in our present world. And in fact, we have an amazing lack of empathy. We are somehow devastated to find that people who lived 100 and 200 and 300 years ago thought differently about us, thought differently from us. So we have to somehow impose our values on theirs. And that, by definition, is a lack of empathy. Then again, where do you go with this? Today it's Robert E. Lee. They're going to rename the Jefferson Davis Highway in Alexandria, Virginia, which is if you've ever been to Washington, D.C., that is a big, you'd take it to go back and forth to the airport. It's a big highway. Renaming that is not a small thing. So today it's Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis. Who's going to be next in Charlottesville? Thomas Jefferson, he was a slave owner. The statues of him all over the University of Virginia. George Washington, what was George Washington's position on gay marriage? We're going to have to take down all the statues of George Washington. So it's not a small thing. Now, to get back to your specific question, LJ O'Neill, was the fiasco deliberate? I think so. They didn't want this protest. The city didn't want this protest to happen. They denied a permit, and it was the ACLU, to their credit, standing up for free speech, that in effect got a court order and made the protest, enabled the protest to go ahead. So they were stymied. So immediately, just before the protest, they then... the city then and the state imposed a state of emergency. The police abandoned the streets, and the police at one point were driving, as you said, funneling the Nazis into the path of the Antifas. And I think it is not unreasonable to say that the city did not want this protest to go off without violence and chaos. In other words, they did not want a coherent protest against Robert E. Lee's removal from Lee Park in that city. And I think there's no doubt that what they did, in effect, was to make violence inevitable. And that's a poor reflection on them. The benign explanation is that the police in Charlottesville are just totally incompetent. The more likely explanation is that, as in many other parts of the country, such as Berkeley, we have a politicized police force acting in advance of certain political objections. And that means that in this case, they wanted chaos. They probably didn't want, let's give them some credit, they didn't want corpses, but they wanted chaos. So they wanted to communicate the message that when the neo-Nazis show up, there is chaos. And the result of that is they abdicated their responsibility for maintaining order. And if that bozo of a police chief is still in his job this time next month, you'll know that something is deeply wrong in the city of in the city of Charlottesville. This isn't to make any comment on, you know, what... President Trump should or shouldn't have said. Yes, at a certain level, it's true that there's a double standard here, that when the left smash everything up, they get a pass on it from the media. And when it's the right-wing guys, suddenly it's the most outrageous thing. And there's all kinds of double standards. When a Bernie Sanders supporter shoots Steve Scalise, for example, that's no reflection on Bernie Sanders. It's just some poor, confused individual with mental health issues. Nothing to do with Bernie Sanders or the Democrats. Whereas when this guy decides to ram his car at a bunch of people, that is on the direct instructions of Donald Trump coming straight from the Oval Office. So, yes, there's a double standard, and we can talk about that if you want. But the broader point is this is a glimpse of the future. There's going to be more of this. And in that sense, it doesn't really matter the rights and wrongs of it. Because once you have a situation where you have identity group politics, I talked about this on Tucker Carlson last week with a guy who seriously thought that LGBTQIA indigenous people and LGBTQIA people of color had the right to exclude LGBTQIA white people from their meetings. You can't actually go on and tell people that everybody is allowed to have an identity group except white men. At some point, white men will say nuts to this and form and turn white males into an identity group, which is what's happening. And it's interesting to me, you know, rioting and destruction is a young man's game. And so the black people you see protesting on the streets and the anti-racists are people who were born 30 years after desegregated lunch counters and school buses and all the rest of it. So they have, it's not just that they have no experience of institutional racism of that kind, their parents don't. And that's even before you say that, well, you know, slavery is 150 years ago. Their argument is that whites are demographically doomed. You hear this phrase all the time, old white men, old white men. They'll be dead soon. They'll be dead soon. But you look at the neo-Nazis. They're young too. And that's because it's true that white people may be about to be demographically eclipsed. That's a statistical fact. But there are still young white men, young whites in their teens and 20s, who have no memory of lunch counters or slavery or anything, and they don't understand why they should be uniquely demonized. So it doesn't really matter the rights and wrongs of this thing. It's just the way it's going to be, any more than the rights or wrongs of Bosnia or Rwanda or Northern Ireland matter. At a certain point, it just becomes a fact of life, and you choose a team. And that's the danger of what's happened here. Tom Lewis, also on this subject, asks, will anyone in Durham, North Carolina, get arrested for ripping down the statue of Robert E. Lee? This happened last night, I believe, that we saw gangs actually tearing down a statue, toppling a statue. Again, as you would normally see, as we saw with the statue of Saddam Hussein after Baghdad was taken by the Americans when people toppled that big statue of Saddam Hussein. That's not a good sign. And again, there is something deeply weird about the politicization of the of law enforcement here. Because if you let a mob tear down a statue, what are you going to do when the mob decides to light up a Taco Bell or a CVS or somebody's home? And it gets to the heart of the problem here. I mentioned that there's a double standard here. For example, there are people who openly hate white people and nobody minds them. There's a guy called Wes Bellamy who goes, I hate seeing white people in Orangeburg. I don't like white people. The funniest thing about being down south is seeing little white men and the look on their faces when they have to look up to you. This guy hates white people. His tweets are all about the white people he hates. He happens to be the vice mayor of Charlottesville. And nobody cares about the things he says about white people. It's okay to openly hate to hate white people if you are as he is. And likewise, a lot of the people who run those cities, like Wes Bellamy and his boss in Charlottesville, think it's okay to selectively cede control of the streets to mobs you approve of. So, for example, these guys tearing down the statue of Robert E. Lee in Durham, North Carolina, that's okay. But if it had been the neo-Nazi guys who'd wanted to tear down a statue of Martin Luther King, that wouldn't have been okay. You can't have essentially political fashion becomes the determination of which mob is allowed to take control of the streets. You are no longer living in a free and functioning society. And one of the repulsive aspects of this, there's a piece in the Washington Post today that says that says simply liberal chit-chat isn't going to cut it with these issues anymore. And that Charlottesville demonstrates that it's time to stop relying on mere words. Liberalism can't defeat white supremacy, only direct action can. This is a guy called N.D.P. Connolly, who's an associate professor at Johns Hopkins University. And he's writing in the Washington Post. He's a words man, but he's saying words aren't going to stop these neo-Nazis. Only direct action, only smashing stuff can, only destroying stuff can, only violence can. And I think we've got it backwards here. We're saying, oh no, you can't say this and you can't say that. We're objecting to President Trump because he didn't tweet the right tweet after what happened, because he didn't say the right thing at a press conference. And we're quibbling about his words while at the same time egging on the mob to go beyond words and smash stuff. And that's a very dangerous path. We actually need more space for a wider range of words and less space for statue toppling and burning businesses. And unless we understand that we need more speech and less mob violence, then we are going to be going to a very bad place here in America. This isn't a funny. The people toppling statues while the police stand by and the mayors stand by is not a good thing and not a good place to be. That is really the significance of what has been happening in Durham, North Carolina. Nathan writes, as a former Catholic, I'm not sure whether that's, no, that's Ian, by the way, wrong question, wrong person. As a former Catholic, I don't know whether that's Ian or me, I'm not really a former Catholic. I was, my mother's family are Catholic, but I was confirmed an Anglican, so I haven't renounced the Pope or anything, as far as I'm aware. Do you think the Roman Church should be worried about claims made by transgender people that they can transform from male to female or vice versa simply by asserting their new gender identity, since this transubstantiation is being performed without due regard for canon law? I wouldn't pretend to be sufficiently expert in canon law to want to answer that. I do think it's very interesting transgender, it seems to me, is actually part of this kind of war on white men that the fellas in Charlottesville are actually so upset about. Because, as I understand the statistics, there's 9 male to female transgenders for every female to male transgenders. In other words, there's 9 Caitlyn Jenners for every 1 Chaz Bono. So it's effectively a massive transfer from the male population to the female population. And it's and I find it fascinating as a phenomenon in a way that I quite understand it. Men are on a hiding to nothing here. They're institutionally discriminated against in all kinds of things. For example, in family court, there's huge bias, institutional discrimination against men. More casually, if you look at all the commercials, there's huge discrimination against men. And there is not a lot. If you look at the 2008 recession, it was effectively a he session. And there was men who lost jobs in manly blue-collar jobs, whereas all the booming jobs, the caring professions and so forth, are more suited to the females. So there's actually very little call for men. There's increasingly little call for men, and one can understand why a certain proportion of men would rather live their lives as women. It's part of what one might call the demasculinization of society. And in that sense, it is an issue for the Catholic Church, because the elimination of sex roles goes to the heart of human identity, all the way back to Adam and Eve in the book of Genesis. And a world in which Adam can be Eve and Eve can be Adam, and it's not a question of using Adam's rib to make Eve or Eve's rib to make Adam, but that Adam can be Eve and have her the critical rib lopped off, or Adam can be Eve and decide to keep the rib, I'm being very discreet here, is in fact one of the bizarre phenomena of our time, and not a small thing in what it indicates. Let's see if we got any other demographic. What do we got here? We're live, by the way. It's I'll do time checks just to prove we're live. We're 4:19 Eastern. That's 1:19 in California, and as I said, that's 8:19 Greenwich Mean Time or 9:19 BST, British Summer Time, Bovine Spongiform Time, whatever it is that you think it stands for. Mark Stillman writes, based on U.S. demographics, it appears that red states will get more electoral votes and blue states will have a lot less in the next generation as amoral millennials choose not to procreate. But will the GOP be amoral as well in a generation? And what is your thinking on the state of religious freedom in the future within the GOP? Yeah, this is an interesting question. People always say that red states... conservatives have more children than liberals and Democrats do. And that's generally true. I mean, for example, the Mormons used to be just kind of this obscure little group confined to Utah. And then you turn your back for a minute and suddenly Mitt Romney is a Mormon presidential candidate and he's running as a Mormon from Massachusetts because Mormons had so many children that they spilled the bounds of Utah and spread out all over the rest of the country. And again, if you look at generally liberal states such as Vermont, for example, it does have a low birth rate, low fertility rate. I live in New Hampshire on the Connecticut River, and if you look at the Vermont schools on the Vermont bank of the Connecticut River, they built those schools on the expectation of traditional population growth, and they have not had that. Young people are leaving Vermont. But on the, if you're saying, I think Mark Stillman is asking whether the GOP will eventually become a secular hedonist party as much as the Democrats are. And I think that's actually a real possibility. You know, one of the most tiresome soundbites of David Cameron was when he decided to go hell for leather for gay marriage. And he was asked whether he supported, why he supported same-sex marriage despite being a conservative. And he said, I don't support same-sex marriage despite being a conservative, but because I'm a conservative. And I, like so much of what David Cameron said, I just wanted to find a bucket and vomit into it. Not because I can well understand that there's a swathe of all conservative parties that wants a quiet life. And so they decide, well, you know, we got this same-sex marriage. It seems like the coming thing. There's no point in us investing energy in opposing it because we're going to lose anyway. So we might as well just give up without a fight. It's not the hill to die on, as conservatives always say. And then they wonder why they've lost all the hills. But it was the fact that but contorting himself into a pretzel to demonstrate why conservatives should champion radical ideas that nobody gave any thought to 20 years ago is not a conservative position. And it seems to me that there is a segment of the Republican Party, a lot of my friends in the Republican Party are already there. There's a big section of young up and comers in the Republican Party who feel that the social issues should all be basically abandoned, and that the Republican Party, in order to win, needs to give up on these things. And then you have what I think was the interesting phenomenon of November. Essentially, Trump had turned the conventional wisdom of the Republican Party that the demographics are against a party with core white support and they should do more to appeal to Hispanics because Hispanics are a more significant thing. He turned that on its head, and he in fact said he opposed illegal immigration and he maximized the support of that supposedly demographically eclipsed white population. So I think there's a danger that the Republican Party just winds up where the Democrats were 10 years ago. And that's certainly the case with conservative parties in the rest of the planet. But it doesn't necessarily have to happen. And it may not be that way. One of the interesting things is that, and again, this is demonstrated by Charlottesville, I think. If you look at, say, for example, Northern Ireland, there used to be the dominant political parties in Northern Ireland used to be a moderate loyalist party and a moderate nationalist party. Both of those have collapsed, and you now have the main parties in Northern Ireland are the Democratic Unionists and Sinn Féin. In other words, a far more hardcore loyalist party and a far more hardcore nationalist party. In turbulent times, the centre is the first thing to collapse. And again, that's true in Bosnia. I know that's not a cheery a cheery comparison for Americans. But people who had been friends, Christian Muslim families who'd been friends in Mostar, wandered back and forth across the bridge every day, suddenly became isolated and in isolated communities. And you started hearing Bosnian Muslims going around saying Inshallah and Allahu Akbar and things they'd never said in millennia. Turbulent times pushes people to the extremes. Kevin Clark writes, not the most important issue perhaps, but would you care to comment on the future for women's sports? It seems inconsistent to integrate the military such that women can storm the beaches at Normandy shoulder to shoulder with men, but still need their own cordoned off safe spaces to play soccer or basketball. Women's sports is dead because of the issue we were talking about just a couple of minutes ago, which is the transgender issue. Every couple of weeks now, there's a story about how some male-to-female transgender has just triumphed in the women's cycling or the track event. There was one in, a high school in Vermont recently where some transgender person, my son, who is a kind of indifferent member of the male track team, has pointed out that if he transitioned, he'd be the state champion in the women's sports. So I think the whole transgender thing is actually going to kill women's sports completely. So you won't have to worry about women's sports anymore because there ain't going to be any of those. Let's see what else we've got here. Thomas Robinson writes, why does McMaster still have a job? This is some of the old palace intrigue stuff that we're getting with the Trump administration. The livelier thing, Reince Priebus has gone, Sean Spicer has gone. And the mooch has gone. So now we're talking about General McMaster. Yeah, what's interesting is that Trump foreign policy, I think, is not quite, and Trump war policy is not quite where he was in the campaign. McMaster is said to be desperate to get rid of Steve Bannon because Steve Bannon is the last alt-right figure remaining in the inner circle. The plan was always that if Trump won, to surround him with people who would turn him into a conventional Republican president. And that's particularly true when it comes to homeland security, foreign policy, matters of war and such like. Trump campaigned as someone who regarded America's 21st century war on terror wars as a waste of time. And not just a waste of time, but a waste of blood and treasure. We've been running around the Hindu Kush for 16 years, and where's it got us? Whatever the reason we went into Afghanistan in the fall of 2001, we're a long way from that in the late summer of 2017. And I supported that. I've said before, I'm basically a 19th century imperialist, 100 years past my sell-by date. And I respect and accept that America does not have an imperialist bone in its body. But Afghanistan, America's longest war, emphasizes, I think, that the American way of war needs rethinking. And one of the reasons to support Trump was that he did not buy into that instinctive, deferential approach to desultory, ineffectual war-making that has dominated the United States since September 11th, 2001, which has not been effective. It has not defeated our enemies, which is the point of war. As I write about in America Alone, the point of war is not to destroy the enemy's tanks, but to destroy his will. Not to crush his military, but to crush his will. To make him understand that he's been defeated, that he's And if you're not prepared to do that, in other words, if you're not prepared to impose total defeat on your enemy, as the Allies did to Germany and Japan in 1945, then you shouldn't be going to war. If you're just going to war to destroy a few tanks here and a couple of planes on an airfield there, you're in war for the wrong reason, and you shouldn't be in it. You shouldn't be in it. So I believe the whole American way of war since 2001 needs rethinking. And I'm disturbed that McMaster is a bit too much of a continuation of the whole desultory, ineffectual, perpetual war that we have seen since 2017. Brian Warner writes, just to lighten up a little, I believe you're something of a fan of Jeeves and Wooster. Your references to Cat's Meat Porter Purbright are a big clue. Did you watch the BBC series or read the original stories, which are wonderful? One of my favourites is Bertie Changes His Mind in Carry On Jeeves, because it's narrated by Jeeves in the first person. Woodhouse is one of my very favourite writers of humour. Have you written much about him other than his Broadway connections? I would love to read your impressions of him and his writing style. Well, if by the series you mean the series with my old Loose Ends confrere Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie, that is a wonderful series. I loved it enormously. I think Bertie, Hugh Laurie was the perfect. I know here in, Americans know Hugh Laurie from whatever that series is he's on American TV. What is it? House? Is that the thing he does on American TV where he does this American accent? I got no time for that. I like Hugh Laurie as Bertie Wooster in Jeeves and Wooster. He was brilliant at that. And I remember the first episode. I was on the radio with Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry about 2 days after that first episode. No, I can't be. It was 6 days. And I said I thought it was very difficult to do adaptations of P.G. Wodehouse, and I thought that was the best. And it's out there. You can get it on Netflix and all kinds of stuff like that, Amazon, and you should see it because it's a great way to spend your day. Hugh Laurie is a perfect Bertie Wooster, and Stephen Fry isn't quite so perfect as Jeeves, but he's good enough. And they were wonderfully adapted by a guy I knew very slightly, Clive Exton. And Clive Exton did Jeeves and Wooster, and he did the Hercule Poirot series that's on PBS, Mystery or whatever it's called. And he had a great career in British television. Lovely man, Clive Exton. He made one mistake in his life. He tried to make it in Hollywood, and he wound up writing stuff like, I think it was Red Sonja and Conan the Barbarian 5 or whatever it was with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And after doing that for a couple of years, he decided his Hollywood dreams were going nowhere, and he went back to Jeeves and Wooster and Hercule Poirot. And I love P.G. Wodehouse. I quoted P.G. Wodehouse with Stuart Varney on Fox Business a couple of days ago. That's how much I love P.G. Wodehouse. let's see what Kathleen Good says. Mark, do you think that these Antifa protesters are being paid by a Soros group? They're being paid. Some of them are being paid by somebody. That's clear because there are ads. There are advertisements for people to come and protest things, and they're given money. But I don't think you necessarily have to be paid. I think you should always be. It's an old line about Pierre Trudeau. When the CIA was wondering whether Pierre Trudeau was in the pay of the Kremlin. And I think it was my old friend George Jonas who said that the CIA simply couldn't get their head around the fact that something they would not be prepared to consider doing for anything but money, that there are people perfectly willing to do it for free, like Pierre Trudeau, who was palling around with Fidel Castro and letting Cuban planes refuel in Canada, in Newfoundland, on their way to Africa, and all kinds of other stuff that he was pulling. And I think that's true here. It's foolish to think that that there are people who will not do this for free. Now, particularly where you live in a culture of middle-aged students, people who are going to college and don't have very much to do, and they're 25 or 26 and they're doing, you know, colonialism and transgender studies, that they don't have time just to do this for free. There is a kind of professional protest demographic that you can always get out in numbers, particularly once you have told them that there's not going to be any price for anything they do, that if they destroy property, they're not going to be punished for it, that they can wear masks and smash buildings and they're not going to be punished for it. It's a great way. It's far more entertaining than just staying home and watching TV or whatever. It's a great fun way to live if you can smash stuff up with impunity. So I think the answer is both of the above. Some of these people are being paid. They're being organized by hardcore leftist organizations funded by George Soros. But on the other hand, some of them are just doing it because it's a fun way to spend your time. It's the most fun way to spend your time. Roy Epen writes, Dr. Roy from Montreal, who, if you ever go to any event almost anywhere in Canada, Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal, you'll find Dr. Roy there. He's an indefatigable attender of events, whether they're with members of the royal family, or I think I saw him with a photograph of standing between a couple of movie stars the other day. So he gets around, Dr. Roy, very sociable. He goes, I loved your articles on Glen Campbell. I had an enormous crush on him when I was younger. He will be very much missed. I love Glen Campbell's voice. Well, I love two things about Glen Campbell. He had a great voice and he was a great guitar player too. He plays on a lot of big hit records. I've mentioned he played on Sinatra, Strangers in the Night, but he's there on You've Lost That Love and Feeling, a lot of big hit records. He was a great guy, and I miss him. And I found it very moving. I touched on this, really, for my own family history. If you've had any experience of dementia, it's almost unbearable if you love someone to watch the cloud descend. Not for selfish reasons. You know, I didn't mind when with my father, for example, when he could no longer say my name or seemed quite clear who I was or any of that. But the loss of human personality, as it's just being eaten away, I think it's very difficult if you've watched that up close not to be profoundly moved by it. Mrs. Thatcher, when this happened to President Reagan, Mrs. Thatcher used a lovely phrase at the service in Washington about how now, in the hereafter, the cloud had been lifted and Ronald Reagan, her friend, was restored. And one hopes it is like that. I was very struck by that line, and I have never forgotten it when Mrs. Thatcher used it at the service for President Reagan. But what was interesting to me was that after he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, Glen Campbell kept on touring for as long as he could because the music stayed. The lyrics stayed and the music stayed, and he could still play and he could still sing, and it was virtually the last thing to go. And as someone who loves music and as someone who loves song, and sometimes my enthusiasm for songs is not understood by people who want me just to talk about jihad, Islamization, the collapse of Western civilization all day long, all week long, all year long, forever and ever as we slip into the abyss of history. The reason I do is because I think that the good Lord did not just by happy accident make it that music and songs are the last thing that remain with us when everything else has been eaten away. There is something primal and essential about it, and you certainly see it in Glen Campbell's last performances. And I thank you for that question, Dr. Roy. Scott Drew says, if you're progressive on social issues, you might as well be a Democrat. Conservatism is more important than party. I'm a proud non-Trumper who was vehemently anti-Obama Hillary, who thought Trump would be a train wreck. Too bad I didn't place bets in Vegas on it. You never know, Scott Drew, it might turn out okay. I will say this, if you're progressive on social issues, you might as well be a Democrat. I'm inclined to agree with that, in the sense that in the 90s, for example, we used to have this clever straddle. People said they were socially liberal but fiscally conservative. And you hear that a lot throughout the Western world. Stephen Harper's ministry in Canada for these last 10 years. Mr. Harper, as Prime Minister, didn't want to go near any of the social issues. If you look in Australia, my old pal Julie Bishop, who introduced me in the Australian Parliament last year, Julie, who's the foreign minister down in Australia, is on the socially liberal wing of her party. If you look at the United Kingdom, as I said, it's almost the Conservative Party doesn't really seem to want to conserve anything. If you listen to Theresa May and some of her wilder ministers over there. America went through this phase in the Republican Party, mainly in the 90s, when you had all these governors, mainly of blue states, Republican governors of blue states, who professed to be socially liberal but fiscally conservative. And they left no trace. Bill Weld, I mean, I can hardly even remember them now, but if I strain, I can. Because if music is the last thing to go in your brain, the names of Republican governors of Democrat states are the first thing you forget. Arnold Schwarzenegger in California. The Terminator couldn't terminate anything. What a bust. What a big nothing. Bill Weld in Massachusetts. George Pataki in New York. Christy Whitman in New Jersey. Scott Drew says they might as well be Democrats. Maybe. But I will say this, that the social liberalism comes at a price. And so the straddle becomes impossible, because the social liberalism in the end overwhelms the fiscal conservatism. So there's absolutely no point to it. You might just as well go. And incidentally, in terms of societal survival, for example, you can't give a free pass to social liberalism. My big thing at the moment is that adulthood starts too late. You know, everybody goes, in fact, there isn't enough adulthood. I've written about this beforehand. You know, we extend adolescence now till 28, 29, 30. And then if you're in Europe and most other developed nations, people retire earlier and earlier. 63, we live longer and longer, but we retire earlier and earlier. 65, 63, 58, 57. And there's not enough grown-up time in between. And so I think that's essentially not a fiscal issue per se, but it's a social issue that has huge consequences. It would be much better if, instead of letting people stay at school until they're 30, we compressed it and let them stay and taught them everything they need to know by the time they were 17, 16, 15. Because that's one reason why we're in demographic death spirals, is because the point of family formation gets later and later and later. So the people who would have their first child, they previously have had their first child at the age of 22 or 23, now have one designer yuppie child at the age of 39. These things are not without consequence. And that's why I don't really waste my time when people start talking about being fiscally conservative and socially liberal. I'm in favour of a decent, by the way, just to be clear on this, I'm in favour of a decent respect for a broad range of opinion. Parties are coalitions, and there's no point making your 80% friend your 20% enemy. But the idea that social liberalism and fiscal conservatism is a coherent philosophy is something I do rather dispute. Mike writes, does Europe have the same phenomenon going on with statues? Do the Irish immigrants and Catholics in the UK object to the Cromwell statue in London remaining in place? I don't. I think, to go back to the point I came in on, I think it's a very barbarians topple statues. And I know I talked about toppling that statue of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad. I was in Iraq shortly after Saddam Hussein fell, whatever it was, 6 weeks or whatever. And I remember crossing the border from Jordan. When you're in Jordan, they've got a kind of personality cult about King Abdullah and his father, King Hussein, there. So every time you go into a small, nothing little Jordanian village, the roundabout that you turn round to get to Main Street, or whatever they call it in Jordan, there'd be a big thing on each roundabout with huge portraits of King Abdullah and King Hussein on. And for those of us who are born within Her Majesty's dominions, you think that's way a bit over the top, the personality cult. But of course, it's an Arab thing. The Arab strongman is visible everywhere. So then I crossed into Iraq. And I think the first town I came to was Root Bar, and then you go to Ramadi and Fallujah. And all those towns along that western highway in Iraq, it was the same thing, except that instead, on the roundabouts, instead of a big portrait of King Abdullah, they had a big portrait of Saddam Hussein. Except that in the weeks since he was toppled, they'd cut the hole out, and they just left the hole there of the dictator. And I can understand that. They don't have that there anymore, but they should have left it like that, because that's a good reminder. This hole is where the dictator used to be. And I don't mind that, because there's a point to that. You've replaced one bit of iconography with another. You've replaced the dictatorial iconography with post-dictatorial iconography. And I saw the same thing in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Iron Curtain. I spent quite a bit of time in Budapest. And they had, during the communist era, all their streets had been named after Marx and Lenin and all the rest of the gang. And they changed them back to their original names. So, for example, whatever it is, the street in Budapest, Empress Elizabeth Street, had been changed to Karl Marx Street. Well, they put Empress Elizabeth Street back, but they'd left the sign saying Karl Marx Street with a big red line under it, as if to say, don't forget, this temporary aberration is over and you are on Elizabeth Street again. But don't forget, we've kept Karl Marx Street, we've kept that nameplate up there with the red line drawn through it, because it's a warning to you that this could come again. Now, what you do when you're just toppling statues, and just to be clear here, Robert E. Lee, under no stretch of the imagination, is Robert E. Lee Saddam Hussein or Karl Marx. And those statues were put up and remained up as part of the post-Civil War reconciliation. So in a sense, you're not you're actually negating not the Civil War and the secession, but you're negating the reconciliation, the post-Civil War reconciliation. And I believe I think that's wrong. You know, you mentioned statues in Britain. Do Irish immigrants object to the Irish immigrants? Irish. I'm not sure. I don't really regard Irishmen as immigrants in London. But Irishmen in Ireland, for example, there's still a statue of Queen Victoria. I think it's in Cork. People have to have a relaxed and healthy attitude to the past. Normally what you get is Ken Livingstone demanding, for example, that the statue of General Sir Charles Napier be torn down in Trafalgar Square, because when Ken Livingstone was mayor of London, he didn't know who General Napier was. Anyone who's read America Alone, my book, knows who General Napier was, because he was the guy who conquered Sindh in India And when the guy came to him and said, we're going to have a big widow burning ceremony tomorrow because we like to practice suti, where when some guy dies, you burn the widow to death on his funeral pyre. That's our cultural tradition. And General Napier famously said, very well. You can build your funeral pyre. Next to it, I'll build a gallows. And then you guys can follow your cultural tradition, and afterwards we'll follow ours. And that's why there's no sooty in India. So General Napier is a great man. And if the mayor of London no longer doesn't understand why there's a statue of him in Trafalgar Square, that's a reflection on him, not on the statue. And that's all that objections to statues generally mean, is that we are now so stupid and live in the present tense so exclusively that we can't relate to these old guys. So we should just have statues of Miley Cyrus and Justin Bieber, and wouldn't that be a really cool world to live in? And so to see ignorant people like those thugs in Durham, North Carolina, mostly white, by the way, actually, because this cold civil war that's getting hotter in America is really between what they call good whites and bad whites, like the bad whites who still think there's a place for statues of Robert E. Lee, and the good whites who are now all hot for disowning their own inheritance. Most of those white people at that demonstration tearing down that statue of in Durham, North Carolina, couldn't tell you the first thing. I'd be surprised if you asked them to name the dates of the Civil War, whether they could get it right to within a quarter century, because we live in great ahistorical times. Jason Corley writes, can we do anything to fix the broken universities that are spreading SJW thought, social justice warrior thought? It doesn't seem possible to change anything about demography, seriously speaking, without changing education first. It seems to me that conservatives have simply abandoned the entire field of education to the left, then act surprised when they lose the culture war. What should we do practically to break the left's stranglehold on education from age 5 to mid-20s? Well, you're right. We have to have a wider range of teachers. I gave a little bit of imperial history there because I'm a 19th century imperialist. That's actually how English values spread around the world, because Lord Macaulay's famous 19th century memo on Indian education, he thought that the best thing you could do for India was give an Indian schoolboy the same education that an English schoolboy had. So that way he would learn about the glories of Greece and Rome. He would learn about Magna Carta and Shakespeare. And that was the greatest gift you could give to a schoolboy in India. And that is why now when you call up tech support, you're talking to Rajiv in Bangalore, because India has a functioning education system, thanks to Lord Macaulay. And you can imagine what it would be like if Iraq, after the fall of Baghdad, the Americans had said, well, we're going to send everybody from the National Educational Association, we're going to send platoons of American teachers to give Iraqi schoolboys the blessings of an American education. They'd have wound up more anti-American than they were under Saddam Hussein. So that's actually, right there, the biggest single structural deformity in America and the Western world today, is that we raise our children to loathe their cultural inheritance, and then we're surprised after you spend 15 years in that system that your kid's on TV in a black bandana pulling down a statue in Durham, North Carolina. So we got to get back in the game in that. And we got to fight that. And it's interesting to me that you say from kindergarten, from the age of 5 to mid-20s. Yeah, it starts. It's not like in the days of the Oxford Union when they voted that this house would not fight for king and country, and it was for pampered English gentlemen enjoying a leisurely varsity among the dreaming spires of Oxford. Now it's gone down through high school, through middle school, through grade school to kindergarten. And so you've got to be in there, and you've got to be engaged with the school board. And it's not a question of pulling your kid out and sending the kid to private school, because most private schools are crazier than the public schools in the sense that they can do all the crazy liberal stuff with a much more unlimited budget. It means you've got to actually push back, because this is where two generations of Americans have been taught that liberalism is the default setting of society, so that the liberal position on climate change is the default setting. The liberal position on transgender issues is the default setting. And conservatism is a cult, a fringe cult that you actively have to embrace. It's a sect that you have to embrace. And I am so opposed these days to our lack of understanding that if we just think of these things, you know, you hear this, the best talk radio guys don't do this, but there are talk radio people who just yell every day about politics in the narrowest terms, as if all that matters is that every other November you drag the guy with the R after his name across the finish line. And the liberals, meanwhile, are playing for the 364 days between elections. And they play very seriously on those fronts, and they win. So if you hear some guy yelling at you, some talk radio guy yelling at you that that the culture doesn't matter, that the schools don't matter, that all that matters is elected politicians, no. Because elected politicians, for the most part, are craven, finger-in-the-windy types who go where the culture is going. So if the culture is trending liberal, it doesn't matter whether you drag the guy with the R after his name across the finish line, because all he's going to do is be playing catch-up to the culture. That's where the battleground is. And the most important battleground is in the schoolhouse. So if your schoolhouse, Al Gore's last movie was shown to my, I forget how many times they wanted my kids to sit through that movie. If they do the same with this movie, this new movie he's made, which has been a complete bust and a stinker and a flopperoo at the box office, and they say, no, your kids are still going to have to sit through this movie, don't pull them out. You got to stand up to this stuff. Say, no, no, no. If you want my kid to come to a Democratic Party meeting, you can send him a political invitation to invite him to the Democratic Party meeting. But if this is a schoolhouse, then you can educate him, and you can teach him history, and you can teach him geography, and you can teach him science. But you do not have a politicized, partisan, politicized form of social engineering, which is what our education. So the only way to fight back against that is to push back against it, wherever it happens. And that's particularly true when it comes to some of these wackier things that where they now, you know, make the boys pretend they're girls for a day and all that kind of thing. Where are we now? Sergei Nirenberg writes, read your comments on late adulthood, an interesting view of cheap sex by Mark Regnerus, by Naomi Schaefer Riley in the latest issue of Commentary. They're both two interesting writers, by the way. The conclusion seems to be that the biological substrate of partner selection has naturally adapted to the technological, the pill, and sociological political feminism changes, and that trumps all the rest of factors in population growth in the West. You've been talking and writing about this for a long time, including today. Is there any realistic hope for us? Anything we as a society can do? There's always hope, Sergei. The numbers are bad. But it is never just a numbers game. And that is the story of that underpins every great heroic narrative in our cultural tradition. Doesn't matter whether you're talking about High Noon, where it's the only man who's willing to stand up to the bad guy, walking alone down the center of Main Street in town when everybody else has fled. The courage of a few can trump the pusillanimousness of the majority. Especially, and that is why free speech issues are important, not because everybody is going to exercise their right to free speech, but because those who are persuasive will exercise their right, and then people will belatedly jump on the bandwagon. The jig is not up, not by any means, and we should not think that it is. I am an optimist. I am a happy warrior. And it is not the majority that determines things. It is the strength of ideas. And if you keep forcefully articulating those ideas, if you talk with your neighbours about them, with your friends about them, then you can change the way people think. And to go back to what I was saying earlier, that is another reason why I don't want to be walled up in an ideological ghetto yelling to the choir, as some people do. Kurt Piper, final. Kurt Piper, it's not a question. He says, singing in the rain is harder than singing in the sun. Yes, up to a point. Singing in the rain. Gene Kelly caught a chill when he filmed that number for the film Singing in the Rain. On the other hand, you may remember that Simpsons episode where there's the John Denver character. It's a heat wave, and he's singing "Sunshine on My Shoulder Makes Me Happy," and some guy slugs him and goes, "Screw you, hippie." So sometimes singing in the rain is harder than singing in the sun, but not necessarily always. We didn't get to all your questions. We never do. I will take some of them up on a special video edition of our Clubland Q&A. But for now, that is it. We are live. It is a minute past 5 o'clock US Eastern Time, 2 o'clock on the West Coast, 6 p.m. for my friends in Somerset, Bermuda, 10 p.m. In the Imperial Metropolis of London, 11 p.m. in Paris. And for all our Aussie and Kiwi and Vanuatuan and Tuvaluan and Solomon Islanderan and Cook Islander members of the club, greetings to you on a bright Wednesday. And this is Mark Stein. We'll see you next time.